From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I've been really trying, baby. Our connection for this hour was made in your bedroom. Now, I don't mean to be crude, but we're talking about sex this hour. There are some significant new trends in American sex lives. Researchers have been looking at how much sex we have and what it means for us in other ways. But wait. If you assume I'm going to say that Americans, particularly young Americans, teenagers, young adults, are having more sex, you're wrong. Here's the recent headline based on new research and the headline from the Atlantic Monthly. Why are young people having so little sex? The Atlantic calls it a sex recession and then writes the following, quote, "These should be boom times for sex. The share of Americans who say sex between unmarried adults is not wrong at all is at an all-time high. New cases of HIV are at an all-time low. Most women can, at last, get birth control for free and the morning after pill without a prescription. If hookups are your thing, Grindr and Tinder offer the prospect of casual sex within the hour. With the exception of perhaps incest and bestiality and, of course, non-consensual sex more generally, our culture has never been more tolerant of sex in just about every permutation. But despite all this, American teenagers and young adults are having less sex," end quote. Now, how much less? Well, it depends on how you measure it, but young adults are having much less sex than their parents and grandparents did. They lived together less often early in their lives. So what gives? What can we learn from this, particularly as it relates to how often people get married and have children? My guests this hour include Dr. Pebble Krantz, who is a sexual medicine specialist at the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. It's great to have you back on the program. Thanks for being here.
I'm delighted to be. Thanks.
And also with us is Dan Rosen, a psychotherapist and certified sex therapist at the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. Dan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. It's an honor.
All right. So we have a lot to discuss. And listeners, if you want to read the Atlantic piece, "Why Are Young People Having So Little Sex?" it is long. There's a lot to it there. And it's, again, it's not just about sex. There's a lot tied to this. But I'm going to ask our guests for their sort of big picture take on the decline in sexual activity. And then we'll talk about some things more specifically. But if you want some stats, let me just read some stats for you to kind of back this up. From 1991 to 2017, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Youth Risk Behavior Survey finds that the percentage of high school students who had had intercourse dropped from 54 to 40%. In other words, in the space of one generation, sex has gone from something most high school students have experienced to something most have not. And no, as the Atlantic notes, they're not having oral sex more often instead either. That rate hasn't changed much. Today's young adults are on track to have fewer sexual partners than members of the two preceding generations. People now in their early 20s are 2.5 times as likely to be abstinent as Gen Xers were at that age. 15% report having had no sex at all since they reached adulthood. And the U.S. teen pregnancy rate has plummeted to a third of its modern high. That's a complex subject, too. But there's just some of the takes, the statistical takes on where we are. Dr. Krantz, what does it tell you? What's your big overarching take from this?
Well, I think it was a fascinating article and covered a lot of bases that are really quite important. I think that there were some changes that were noted that are concerning. For instance, a decrease in number of teen relationships. Similarly to the Dutch concern that a decrease in teen relationships may be leading to some skipped developmental opportunities, an opportunity to understand how to deal with heartbreak, an opportunity to understand how to balance romance and the rest of the responsibilities we have in life. That is concerning that teens are having less opportunity to experience and experiment with those important life changes and issues. I do also think it points out that the internet does give us some more available, easily accessible ways to feel like we're connecting and even to get sexual pleasure, but they may be less satisfying in the end and often are. And this idea that there's a balance between the connection that we can have digitally and the connection that we can have IRL in real life is getting unbalanced. I do think those are some concerning things. Meanwhile, I think it is true that possibly people are having less unwanted sex, and that's a good thing. An increase in understanding about sexual consent, an increase in both young and older people being able to define the kind of sex they want to have and with whom, that's fundamentally, I think, a good thing.
If I could just expand on that point for one moment here, our listeners may hear that and go, wait a second, isn't Dr. Kranz just saying there's less sexual assault? Or not necessarily the case. As The Atlantic points out in their piece, some people today may feel less pressured into sex that they didn't really want to have. And this is where that gray area is. Coerced sex, pressured sex, need to sort of conform. In other words, there may be just more independence, often among young women, but not always, to say, you know what? No, I'm not going there, and I don't need to say yes for this relationship. That possibly may be a good outcome here.
Absolutely. One of the things that I talk with clients a lot about is the only way to free up a real yes is the ability to say no. That is key. We have to, if we feel like we can't say no, or conversely, I guess the ability to feel like we can say no to things that we don't want allows us to enjoy more of what we are saying yes to.
Okay. Dan, what's your big overarching take from the piece there and from these statistical trends in sex?
Well, I think it's great that you're doing a show on this. I think it's great that more studies are being done about the sexual behavior in the American population. That's not always been the case. You know, you're talking about numbers that have changed over really broad periods of time. Ideally, we'd be getting smaller chunks of time, and we'd have more of a priority to understand how the American populace is engaging in sex. If we look back to the HIV epidemic when it was beginning, if there was more attention paid to the kinds of sex that people were actually having, then thousands and thousands more people would be alive today. So I think it's fantastic this is being studied. In terms of how this information will be used, I think Dr. Kranz elaborated a little bit on some of the great messaging, but how I get concerned about how information like this will get used. if we know that there's less sex because most of the sex that occurs is in marriage, then what might happen and efforts to have more people get married? I think there's a lot more economic opportunity, and we've had liberalization of divorce laws. Would people want to try to roll things like that back? Would be a concern. And I haven't heard an agenda like that, but I'm just saying that whenever new information comes out, I start to wonder who's going to use it and how.
Yeah. And just in terms of some of what Dan's talking about, more sex occurring within marriage, it's true. And Americans now getting married a little older. They're living at home with parents a little longer, which, as The Atlantic Monthly points out, no one has to tell you, is not great for a sex life. The average American's having sex 54 times a year now, down from 62 times a generation ago. So there's a lot of statistical backing for the idea that sex is happening less often. Let's focus on one of the concerning aspects of this that Dr. Kranz has highlighted, mentioned it before the program, the concern about pornography and maybe porn addiction. So there's been a lot written and sort of kind of postulated about what that means. And I want to ask you sort of out of the gate here, if you see porn as sort of a net societal negative, or do we wring our hands too much about it? Is addiction common? How do you view that?
I think I'm going to take those two things separately.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. So porn. Porn doesn't have to be a bad thing. It is a exploration of desires in a fictional world. And for people who are interacting with it, like fiction, it can not only be neutral on a partnered sexual life, but can also be positive. In fact, there are some studies that show that couples that use porn together have better sex lives. That being said, it can be a wedge sometimes in a couple, particularly when there's one member of the couple who feels like it is a betrayal, and another member of the couple may be feeling like that's the sexual outlet that they're getting the most from. And so it becomes very complex. Another thing that I like to think about porn, and can I use the M word on the air?
Masturbation?
That one.
Well, yes, of course we can. Okay. And we're talking very clinically about sexual behavior, and we should probably let listeners know again, that's the subject this hour. And it's not just about sex. It's about what it says about us, about our relationships, about healthy relationships. But if you're happening to listen to the program in a context where you might be less comfortable with that, just know, we're not going to be cursing on the air. We're not going to be using sort of crude terms, but we will. But we'll be talking clinically about terms. So
thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for
clarifying.
But
can you say masturbation? Yes.
Oh, great. Good.
Okay.
So I do, I hear from a number of people that at times masturbation is a sexual outlet that can help with decreasing anxiety. It's reliable, good experience. And sometimes partnered sex is filled with anxiety and it doesn't feel so good because of that worry about how it's going to go, particularly if there's some kind of concern about sexual function involved. And so, of course, why wouldn't you want to do the thing that is relaxing and makes you feel safe and comfortable and get pleasure? And so I think it's important to realize that most human beings need a sexual outlet. And sometimes that's going to be masturbation, and masturbation often uses erotica or porn. So that's one thing. And another thing that I like to mention to people is it doesn't have to be an exclusive or binary relationship, that people can like porn as let's say porn is pistachio ice cream and partnered sex is Cherry Garcia. You can like both pistachio and Cherry Garcia equally, or you could like Cherry Garcia a lot more but be willing to take pistachio from time to time, or vice versa. And a good sex life really needs variation. And it needs a willingness to have a template for a sexual experience that is that's varied. So that's one thing. So that's
who says connections isn't interesting? We just got ice cream flavors to describe porn. So, but I think the point is well made. Also, as we continue on this theme, the article points to a lot of research indicating that masturbation is the one thing that has increased pretty significantly in our society among young adults, American adults, and among teenagers. So that is on the rise, which could be linked to a rise in the use of pornography. Probably.
I think that we're talking about masturbation more. We're admitting masturbation more.
Okay, so you're more skeptical there?
I'm a little bit more skeptical, yes. But unfortunately, we don't have a lot of data to help us refine that. Is it a matter of report? Because we can't go back to 1992 and really define what people were reporting.
All right. So before I turn to Daniel, let me just follow up on one important thread here, because you're talking about what can be a healthy use of pornography in a relationship that needs variety. And as you say, human beings are sexual creatures and probably need some form of variety. But if you have pistachio and Cherry Garcia in your freezer, is it a problem if you're not really, enjoying Cherry Garcia much, but you're sneaking pistachio all the time and you're not telling anybody, and is that a problem? And you feel like you can't stop, like every day you need the pistachio ice cream, but you're denying that you need the pistachio ice cream. This has gotten a little weird, but I mean but really this is about addiction. And when does it become an addiction? When is it a problem?
So the whole question of whether we can be addicted to things like food and sex that are a normal part of human existence mm-hmm. is fraught with complication
and controversy,
absolutely. And also it's very culturally and socially weighted question. As far as the evidence that's available, the scientific evidence that's available, the jury is really still quite out on whether it's possible to be addicted to sex.
Or addicted to pornography.
So, I mean...
It has to do somewhat with the definition of the term. I think to the lay public, addiction is a very broad concept, and people feel that they can be addicted to exercise, they can be addicted to connections, they can be addicted to a variety of things. If you try to operationalize addiction, what changes do we see in the brain, which is a relatively new idea in addiction? It used to be more behaviorally defined. If you look at the most recent psychiatric definitions of substance use, they've actually moved away from addiction language. We talk about substance use disorders as opposed to dependence versus abuse. So things that feel like an addiction, for people to call it an addiction, can be helpful. Can it be operationally studied and defined as such is the part that is really unclear, I think.
Okay, but in the Atlantic piece, and some of our listeners are asking about that, we'll post it for you on our various platforms if you want to check it out. And again, you got to set aside a lot of time to read it. It's a long piece. It's very detailed. They touch on some of the more recent criticisms of not just pornography, but the rise in rates of self-gratification. And let me read this section, and we'll get the experts' take on if there's validity in some of these concerns or criticisms. And I'm quoting from the article now. Quote, "Today, masturbation is even more common, and fears about its effects, now paired with concerns about digital porn's ubiquity, are being raised anew by a strange assortment of people, including the psychologist Philip Zimbardo, the director of the famous Stanford Prison Experiment, who is enjoying an unlikely second act as an anti-porn activist. In his book, Man Interrupted, Zimbardo warns that procrasturbation, his unfortunate portmanteau for procrastination via masturbation, may be leading young men to fail academically, socially, and sexually. Gary Wilson, an Oregon man who runs a website called Your Brain on Porn, makes a similar claim. In a popular TEDx talk, which features animal copulation as well as many human brain scans, Wilson argues that masturbating to internet porn is addictive, causes structural changes in the brain, and is producing an epidemic of erectile dysfunction," end quote. There's a lot there that could make any parent want to sit down a young child and say, let's not get addicted, and internet porn is inherently addictive, if you believe that stuff. Dan?
Well, I think that those two people, there's questions about whether they're really the experts on this. The experts that we have studied and read are doing more nuanced studies. I am not aware that Gary Wilson is the expert on male masturbation, and many other researchers have looked at how discussions of pornography, when you don't talk about how it's used for masturbation, lead to conclusions that make it look like it's the problem, where it's pretty normal for people to masturbate, and they tend to like pleasurable things when they masturbate. Some of the effects that are alleged about pornography can be due to normal sexual function. For example, if we talk about a refractory period, the ability of a person to have a second pleasurable sexual experience with orgasm, that there's a period of time that takes place after release in order to be able to do that again. And that might not be factored in when people think about impaired sexual functioning when they've been using masturbation and pornography.
Okay. Dr. Kranz, what do you make of what you just heard there from The Atlantic?
Well, so orgasms do change the neurotransmitter environment in the brain briefly after having an orgasm. So does sugar. So does So do SSRIs. So do the changes in hormonal environment in the brain during adolescence. So do nicotine and opioids and alcohol and all kinds of other substances that we do worry a lot about physiologic dependence with. Those changes, those brief changes in the brain, they feel good. And of course, we really like the things that make us feel comfortable and warm and cozy and satisfied and unworried. And so it's not surprising to me that sometimes people would want to have that outlet and that release, and that sometimes one might choose to feel relaxed and unworried in those ways, rather than to feel anxious and upset in the ways that life can otherwise make us feel anxious and upset. So I guess I'm trying to say that I understand why it's appealing. Meanwhile, I don't think that there's any evidence that either masturbation or porn are things that are changing our brains permanently. That's the thing that's the jury that's still out.
To your point about how this functions, the masturbation and pornography vis-a-vis the question of sexual activity, I personally do think that it's very possible that access to pornography and knowledge about masturbation, the fact that more people think of it not as a sinful thing and not as abnormal, probably means that there's more reporting of it and there's more use of that. And is that correlated? Could that be correlated with a reduction of partnered sex? Yes. Do we think that some people get so entrenched in a habit that for all intents and purposes, it's an addiction, and that those people then can't relate socially with other people, can't get into vulnerable social interactions and share experiences with another human being? Absolutely. I think that's a real problem. We see people in our clinic who have difficulties with having become so accustomed to pornography and masturbation that the idea of trying to meet another human and be sexual with them is incredibly threatening. And then I'm sure some of the listeners are thinking about how the people in porn are mostly actors or really good amateurs, and that a lot of people feel that they can't compete with those bodies and those kinds of performances.
That's an excellent point.
And that you get body image distortions and people thinking that they're not a worthy sex partner. And if you talk about self-esteem and how pornography can lower some people's self-esteem, yes, I think that that can happen.
What an important point. You want to add a little bit to that?
Yeah, I think that it's confusing when if people are seeing a lot of porn and the kind of sex that happens in porn and the way that sex happens in porn, it's just not realistic. It's fiction. And I think there are a lot of young people who expect that that's the reality. And it's replacing some old bad myths that we had about sex with new bad myths about sex, about bodies and how they're supposed to look, about how sex is supposed to happen. Do women want to be, pounded away at? Is that what is going to give them the most satisfaction? Mm. Well, frankly, no. Anatomically, no. But if a young person who hasn't had other sexual experiences and that's all they're seeing in porn, they feel like that's what they need to do in order to give their partner pleasure. If they're in a heterosexual kind of sexual situation. And that is incredibly damaging because it leaves us with without that curiosity about our partners and that openness and that playfulness that allows us to have a good sexual experience. If we are coming into it with all these ideas about how it's supposed to look and what's supposed to happen and how it's supposed to feel, all of that is just damaging.
Dan?
Yeah, and just you asked what our sort of one of the main points we want to get across is. So again, as Dr. Krantz said, the jury's out on a research-based definition of addiction, but I would be interested in how people would use information like that. Utah has called porn a public health crisis. This country has experimented with prohibition. So I think that porn literacy and understanding what happens, and for people to be educated about their bodies, the more people are educated about their bodies, the less they have to rely on pornography. So where would that information go is one of the questions, and maybe not really time to explore that too much now, but I think that's one of the components of it.
All right, so I've got some feedback I want to get to, but I want to kind of coming back to the main theme here, which is that American teenagers and young adults are having less sex than their parents and grandparents did. The important point in regards to pornography is, I think with the advent of the internet, there was some real consternation that pornography, if it's freely accessible in the way that it was in video form, it would just lead to, number one, adolescents, kids discovering it, and that they would start their own sexual lives earlier. Well, they're starting their sexual lives later with the Adventist, which is, at the very least, we don't see unprotected sex all the time, all over the place, as some of the darkest predictions were. Now, there are other effects, but that's one of the interesting things here, is that teenagers and young American adults are having less sex, fewer sexual partners.
I'm assuming the article uses the word sex for intercourse.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But oral sex rates are the same. Generation to generation, masturbation rates are higher. So that's part of what the mm-hmm. research tells us. And we're trying to understand it.
So yeah, masturbation sex is higher, partnered intercourse is lower.
Okay. That's how you refer to it.
Partnered in.
You said masturbation sex is higher.
Well, it's all sex.
It's
right?
All sex. That's okay. It's all sex.
Okay, probably not to teenagers and young adults. It's interesting because when you ask that question, how they define it, that's very interesting. So let's do this. Let's get Rich in Rochester, who's on this subject, and then we're going to kind of go in different directions as we talk about sex rates and young adults. This is Rich. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing, Evan?
Good.
One of the guests were talking about when people get into masturbation, they end up maybe isolating themselves socially, some people, as they get deeper into it. I wonder if that's just a symptom of who that person is anyway. I don't know if that's the way most people will react to masturbation. I think sometimes it's part of complementing their sexuality, whatever. But I think also there's a part of it that I like the part of the getting rid of the taboo of masturbation, because that can be psychologically damaging in itself. When a young person is doing something that is as natural a drive as there is, yet through religion and whatever else, that being told this is the worst thing you can do. So I just wonder if that evaluation of that person isolating themselves is more about that person, and this is just a symptom of what they do in their life in general.
It's an interesting question. Thank you, Rich. What do our guests think?
Could we envision a world in which there was less taboo and shame around masturbation and the person wouldn't have to isolate? They would be able to, would a 13-year-old be able to ask their parents about their thoughts about masturbation? And I think that people who are introverted tend to behave introverted. But when it comes to something that people get a message, we shouldn't talk about it that much, it's shameful, then they are probably going to do it covertly.
Okay, so let me read some more of the other feedback here. We had a listener who called in off air to say, I'm taking medication that affects my sex drive. I'm a millennial. That's a reason I'm having less sex.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah? Yes, we hear a lot about that. I see a lot of that in not only my sexual medicine work, but also in my work in primary care. There are a number of medications that can get in the way of desire, of arousal, of orgasm, and get in the way of having any kind of sex.
And those medications are being prescribed more often now than they were a generation or two
Absolutely.
Ago.
Absolutely.
Oh, sure.
And antidepressants, anxiolytics. I mean, we have more diabetes and hypertension. I mean, this is not talking so much about young people, but certainly antidepressants
What about opioids, Dr. Krantz?
And opioids, thank you, have a profound effect on sexual desire, erection function, drive for sex, and can actually lower testosterone levels over time when taken for a long time. So, you know, also very prevalent. But antidepressants are the things that I think we think about the most. They're more commonly prescribed. Perhaps we have more anxiety and depression. But I think one of the things that's complicated is it's difficult because anxiety and depression decrease desire and can decrease sexual arousal. But then also the medications can too. So sometimes taking the medication and decreasing the amount of depression and anxiety can be helpful.
Dr. Krantz, what would you tell a patient if they said to you, and this is a hypothetical, but I've heard this. People who say, I need the medication as an antidepressant, but I also want my sex life back.
Absolutely.
What do you say to that?
I say let's work on adjusting these medications in a way that we can make that possible. Let's work on all the other ways we can step on the gas of your
which is possible?
Desire. Absolutely, that's possible.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, there are a variety of ways to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that having a sexual medicine specialist in town is a unique opportunity for the community because a lot of mental health providers and physicians are going to have less awareness of the treatments for reduced desire that can occur either from anxiety, depression, or the medication treatments.
I'm late for our only break. If you're on the phone, we're going to try to get as many phone calls and emails and comments as we can. If you want to call the program as we talk about the decrease in sex in this country, particularly among teenagers and young adults, but it's really everyone if you look at statistics across the board, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Our guests from the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness, Dr. Pebble Krantz and Dan Rosen, and we're right back with your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. A local group is headed to Albany to lobby for what they call schools, not jails. They have an approach to education and discipline that they say is different from traditional models that we have seen, and they say those models have done a lot of damage, and we will discuss the issue on Tuesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. We're hearing from a lot of listeners, and I'll read one. Adam just writes the program and mentions the economy, says, Evan, your last hour was all about the economy. This hour, you can't ignore the economy. More people living with their parents later into their lives. That's not exactly a great place to be cultivating a sex life. That's fair from Adam. I mean, it is true that with this economy, more people are living at home with family, with parents later into their lives. And undoubtedly, that impacts developing relationships, developing sexual relationships. No doubt about that. Yes.
No doubt about
no
that.
No doubt and about that.
The Atlantic article addresses this.
Yep.
And I also looked at a Reddit about the article, and there's a lot of talk of we're broke. That's why that's part of what's going on here.
Yeah. Okay. And then Dan, you've got a quote from another. What do you have there?
I have a quote from a young person, young 20s, that I talked to a few people to try to get a sense of what the experience of younger people themselves. My generation is very educated about sex. We are having sex that is pleasurable and desired. We do it when and if we want to. Casual sex is liberating because there's more freedom of choice.
Okay, that's very interesting because it hits on a couple things. And the last line turns a little bit on its head because what they're saying is casual sex, which used to be sort of viewed with some opprobrium by the masses in the past, at least publicly, is now more accepted among younger generations. But they're not having a ton of it, according to the research. So, but the first part of that indicates they're okay with that. but they don't feel pressured to do it very often. Is that right?
That is what I heard, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I thought that one of the statistics from the article was very interesting about people in the book about hookup culture, I think, by Lisa Wade. I'm sorry, I can't remember who. But okay. The idea that 33% are of people are engaging or are abstaining from hookup culture. Less than a third are dabblers in hookup culture. And less than 25% are enthusiasts about hookup culture, with others in long-term relationships, leaving a pretty small number in long-term relationships. But I think what's important to note is that for some people, casual sex and hookups are a great, exciting way to have sex. And for other people, it is not a great, exciting way to have sex. And both of those things are okay. I think, you know, I think about this a skiing metaphor. So if you are skiing down a slope for the first time, it may be exhilarating. You may not fall down. You may have an awesome time. And that's great on that first run of the ski slope. But then another person may fall down a lot. It may be terrifying. They may not enjoy it at all because it's not fun. But the fourth or fifth ride down that ski slope may be better. So the more that some people, the more they understand their partners in a relationship context, may have better sex that way. Meanwhile, there are other people who may have really great sex when they don't know their partners. And there really just is no one-size-fits-all here.
The U.S. unwanted teen pregnancy rate is now down to a third of its high. And a listener was asking, is this evidence that abstinence-only education works? And the answer to that is no. Teen pregnancy is down, but it is still highest in states where abstinence-only education is prominent, and it is lowest in states where there's almost no abstinence-only education. That is just a simple fact. I know correlation isn't causation, but that's one where it's pretty easy to make the link. So the highest rates of unwanted teen pregnancy are in the contiguous American South. That it's a block of states that emphasize abstinence-only more than is emphasized in the Northeast. So just some interesting statistical information. I want to get back to your phone calls. We've got a lot to work through. This is Carrie in Penn Yan next. Go ahead, Carrie.
Hi, Evan. I just wonder how much today's parenting styles might be affecting how much sex teenagers are having. I know I don't feel like my mom was such a great role model for me, and that might have caused a little bit of my behavior when I was younger, and I feel like my daughter, along with hopefully good parenting, and a lot of the messages they're getting in school, like, you know, not doing drugs and better health education and stuff like that, I think maybe I feel like my 14-year-old daughter is a little bit more mature than I probably was at around 18.
Okay. What do you think, Dr. Kranz?
Well, I do think that parenting style plays a role, and the Atlantic article talks a little bit about this, too, about helicopter parenting and the pressures of academics and activities and decrease in unstructured, unsupervised time leading to a decrease in relationships. So parenting style, absolutely, I fully agree, Carrie, has an impact here. I do also think that we are doing a little bit better over time in parenting with allowing kids to feel like they can have conversations about sex with us as parents, with parents. But we can do better. And the more, and we know that the cultures in which people feel, where young people feel like they can have good, real conversations with their parents about sex, those teens grow up with healthier sex lives. And so as much as we can encourage that, I think is great.
Carrie, how do you feel about communication on these issues with a 14-year-old?
I'm all for it, I think. I just I tend to randomly ask my daughter questions like out of the blue and just see what she answers, you know. Have you done this? What are your friends doing? Or, you know, do your friends date? I mean, she doesn't even have a boyfriend in ninth grade, and I think that's great.
Mm. Carrie, thank you. Interesting phone call. And we have lit up the phones, so let's get through as much as we can here. Levi writes to us and says, as a young person, I know a lot of people in long-distance relationships, with women increasingly pursuing careers of their own and enhanced technology such as FaceTime, Skype, texting. Long-term relationships are more necessary and feasible. Frequent sex is not possible in these situations. That's a piece of anecdote, but yeah.
Frequent intercourse is not possible in those situations.
A distinction from a therapist that, again, you go back to various kinds, including probably sexting or sexual contact contact via FaceTime or sexual relationship via FaceTime.
I think that people are having sexual conversations and sexual experiences when they're not face-to-face.
Okay. Yeah.
Mediated digitally.
All right. Levi, thank you for that. In Naples, Michael has a comment on spirituality. Go ahead, Michael.
Hello, thanks for taking the call. Yeah, I'm big piece about sex I'm not hearing talk about. We talk about the physical aspects, emotional aspects, but the spiritual piece hasn't been addressed. And I'm finding it disturbing to hear a professional sex therapist condoning and promoting pornography outside of marriage, promoting pornography in a marriage. And I'm wondering, where's the spiritual connection there? Casual sex without the spiritual connection. So, is it the close bond between two people, not just emotionally, and how does it affect the marriage when a partner says, I'm not enough for you, you need to see strangers having sex? So where's the sexual component to that?
Okay, Michael, thanks
for the spiritual connection.
Thank you for the phone call, Michael. Dan, Dr. Kranz?
Well, spirituality is absolutely an important part of the sexual experience. I think one of the things that's amazing about sex is that it really is this meeting point between emotional health, physical health, spiritual health, and mental health, and so spirituality for many people is a really important part of a sexual connection. Absolutely. It's not a key component for some people. But I think for a lot of people, that sense of, what that merging, that idea of, merging and coming together and having that kind of pleasure and experience with another person is profoundly spiritual. I fully agree with you on that point.
Okay. Dan?
Well, whenever sex and, religion and spirituality come together, it's fraught with controversy. So we know a woman who recently passed away, Gina Ogden, whose life's work was talking about the intersection of spirituality and sex and how sex was a spiritual experience for women and really opened America's eyes to the pleasure and spirituality of women's sex. Another person we know, Tina Shermer Sellers, wrote a book about I think it's about purity culture, about the effects of abstinence pledges and how when people, this is talked about in the article too, when people turn off their sexuality for a particular code of some kind, they may have a tremendous amount of trouble getting it back. I think there's a quote in the article, if you haven't been sexually active by age 25, there's a good chance you're not going to be sexually active. And then lastly, within any relationship, we're completely supportive of the consensual relationships that romantic partners make. And if that fidelity agreement between people is that you don't look at pornography and you don't masturbate, then that's an agreement that those people have gone into. And many people choose to do those things, and they choose to do it with a vow of spirituality and religiosity. And we wouldn't threaten that. We support relationships. In fact, this whole article is talking about how a lot of sex happens in relationships, and how do we support that?
Okay, Dr. Kranz, I think the caller, and I don't want to speak for Michael, but I think he is doubting how consistent a relationship can hold up without a spiritual component, or even really a sexual relationship outside of marriage. And it sounds to me like your view is that consenting relationships with good communication, that's the grounding for a good sex life, more than whether it's codified in marriage or, you know, it sounds to me, I don't want to speak for you. What do you think?
Well, I guess I would echo what Dan was just saying about the agreement that sure. two people make. And there are some people who make that agreement in marriage, and there are some people who make that agreement without marriage. And I think one of our societal problems is that we are not particularly specific when we come to what that agreement means for each party in that marriage or relationship, and that that's really where the money is. What those contracts, those contracts of relationship are about.
Well, and it does seem, this article does seem to indicate, again, going back to the idea of young adults, teenagers having less sex, but maybe communicating about it better than previous generations, or more consistently when it comes to what consent is, what wants and desires are. So even if they want it less often, there does at least, and again, this is a broad statement, I understand it's different case to case, but having those difficult conversations, or conversations that can be difficult, mm-hmm. Is something that maybe the youngest adults are doing more effectively. I don't know.
I think that's a good possibility. When I talk to the young people around me, I hear that that there's a lot more clarity around when it's okay to touch and be touched, and that is good. At the same time, I also hear that they're touching each other less, which also concerns me.
Okay. Well, a consent conversation by its nature doesn't have a known conclusion until it's done. So some consent conversations are leading to contact, and some consent conversations aren't.
All right, back to your phone calls. John and Webster next. Go ahead, John.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I've met Dan just briefly once, casually, but I wonder if either of them have counseled someone who has always had post-coital depression. Mm. I've had it ever. I was born, I'm 80, I was born sexually ambiguous, but I developed as a male, 6'4" and everything else. But I've always had, and I've had three children, but I've always had postcoital depression. It just bothered me, ever since I first had sex when I was about 20 years old. So I wonder if you've ever counseled people like that or whatever.
Dan, Dr. Kranz?
There is a new understanding of an entire complex of symptoms that can happen after people have orgasm called post-orgasmic illness syndrome. And there's just now new understanding, and all kinds of things can happen after sex, after orgasm. That doesn't, I want to sort of let you know that there is research going on about that. There's a new understanding of it. That doesn't help you particularly in this moment. And I'm going to turn to Dan for the...
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling, John. I think that, what we offer is boots on the ground in the community to help people with their sexual questions and to understand themselves better. And being born sexually ambiguous is going to may leave some lifelong questions about sexual identity and sense of virility and how self-confident somebody is. So I think it's great that despite that, you ended up fathering children and have made it to 80, and that's lovely. When we do talks, we hear all kinds of questions like this that we think of as sort of a niche issue, but there's, for every 1 in 100, if we do an audience of 100, there's one in that audience.
That's true.
Yeah, John, thank you, and thank you for being willing to share that. I mean, we've gone in a lot of different directions as we've talked about the decline in sexual activity among young Americans, young adults, teenagers. They're having less sex than their parents and grandparents did, according to a lot of new research. And so I want to ask our guests in the last 90 seconds or so to share kind of conclusions here as we wrap up here. Either what concerns you or what makes you optimistic about some of these findings here. I'll start with Dr. Krantz, about 45 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just optimistic that people are talking about sex. That's heartening that people are having a conversation about it. It's also heartening that that young people are understanding consent in a different way, and that hopefully this will lead to better sex, good sex, if not more sex.
Meaningful, fulfilling sex.
Meaningful, fulfilling sex.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the premise is that people are, we're disappointed that people aren't having pleasurable sex that they want to have. And what are the obstacles in your personal life and societally and structurally that get in the way of that? So I'm optimistic that studies like this help us to overcome those obstacles.
Well, we've worked through a lot. And again, it's a long piece. But there's a lot to it, a lot of research and a lot of different ideas about why these trends are happening. There's not any single one answer, and I think that's what you've heard this hour. It's not just internet porn is more available or, you know, any one thing. It's a combination of factors, but it's not just about sex. It's about us. It's about the young adults who are coming into their own and what it means for them. So I want to thank our guests for being here from the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness, Dr. Pebble Granz and Dan Rosen. Thank you both for being here. Really appreciate that.
Thank you so much. We're delighted.
Thank you.
And our thanks to the engineer of Connections, Rob Braden, and the producer is Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.